supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Gottlieb, thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. As you heard in the billboard to today's show, we're going to be talking about male survivors of sexual abuse, how they recover and can ultimately thrive in life. We're doing this in light of two new books that take on the subject. Listen, I've talked on the radio before about how I have my own history of being sexually abused as a 12-year-old. In preparation for the program, as I got familiar with my guest's writing, it opened the door to my own experience a little wider. I'm going to talk more about this at the end of the show. First, though, let me introduce my guests. They are Joel and Nina Hoffman and Dr. Howard Fradkin. Joel and Nina Hoffman are co-editors of The Survivors Project, Telling the Truth About Life After Sexual Abuse. It's a collection of essays by survivors of sexual abuse. In it, Joel tells his own story of having been abused by his stepfather. Joel and Nina are husband and wife, and they join us here in the studio. Joel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Nina, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
And I'm joined by psychologist Howard Fradkin. He's the author of Joining Forces, Empowering Male Survivors to Thrive. He chairs the Male Survivor Weekends of Recovery Program and is co-founder of Male Survivor. He joins us by phone. Howard, hi.
Hi, Dan. It's an honor to be here.
To our listeners, please be advised, this topic is not for everyone, certainly not for our younger listeners. And of course, we're taking your phone calls. Our number is 888-477-9499. Howard, let's start with you. What makes it harder for men to disclose sexual abuse? After all, it's hard for everyone.
It is hard for everyone. It's especially hard for men, Dan, because our socialization teaches us that men are supposed to be strong, brave, in control, and should never ask for help. And so, unfortunately, when men are sexually abused, they suffer a tremendous amount of shame because they feel inadequate. They feel like they're responsible. They should have taken care of it. They should have stopped it. And they face so much shame that they're unable to speak that truth, oftentimes for decades.
So we know that abuse is horrific for all children, sexual abuse. How is it different for boys? What's the different impact, or is there one?
One of the major differences is that shame tends to lock a man up inside much more than for women. Not that it's ever in our society okay for women to be abused, but somehow it's more okay for women to talk about being abused. It's more understood that women are victims. It's not at all understood yet to this day that men are victims as well, and because of all that shame, it makes it just very difficult for men to speak up, and unfortunately, rarely do they come to therapy to talk about being abused. They come to therapy for many other reasons when they do find that courage, but it's much more difficult, and unfortunately, people in our society don't think about men being victims, and so a lot of men suffer in silence for long times.
Howard, you were abused as a child. When did you come out? When did you begin to tell your story, and what was it like for you?
Dan, I really didn't begin to deal with my own abuse until long after I was a practicing psychologist, and I was dealing with many clients who had been abused, and my own memories started to surface at that time. So my own abuse history and recovery took me to have to face it head on, and unfortunately, you know, I was suffering from the same things that my clients were suffering from, and I got the help that I needed because I wanted to be helpful to them, and I knew if I didn't get help myself, that wasn't going to happen.
When did you tell your story, and what was it like for you?
Well, I told my story to my own psychologist and then was able to talk to other male survivors through the organization malesurvivor.org. So I found a tremendous amount of support. And the psychologists that I worked with some body workers who really were very effective in helping free me from the shame that had trapped me for a long period of time.
Yeah, I want to talk about that, that body business, the physiology. Joel Hoffman, your essay begins with your crying alone as an adult and all of the emotions surrounding your sexual abuse by your father when you were 5 years old. These emotions begin to come out. You had the dry heaves, and you were afraid of being discovered by Nina. What were you afraid of, Joel?
It had been difficult for a while for us, even before that moment, and this was right before I was planning to speak out publicly and identify myself as a survivor. Nina had suffered so much that I was trying my best to be able to deal with it by myself. And yeah, the thought of releasing that information publicly physically made me ill, where I thought I would probably vomit, and I never did, fortunately, but, you know, lots of times when you see flashbacks portrayed, particularly in television and movies, you see this visual montage that is very clear. You know, sometimes they play with the effects, but for lots of people, there are these body memories that are all they have, and that's all I really have. I see flashes here and there, but really that's what tells me that it happened most of all.
Your body memories.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about that as it all started with a bodily sensation. What was it?
At the time, I felt my chest getting really tight, and I was having very difficult time breathing. And sometimes I can feel tremors in my hands, and, you know, it's hard to explain to people why I react in that way, but I used to for a very long time just retreat, and I wasn't able to express it really to anyone until I got through the initial catharsis of letting the emotions out on my own. But
I want to come back to my question. You were afraid of Nina catching you at your most vulnerable.
Yes.
What was the fear ultimately?
The fear of letting her see how deeply damaged I am. And I feel much more comfortable talking about it now, but that shame still exists for me. Fortunately, it gets diluted over time, but you know, it was still very raw then, and this was right before I was going to announce it to a room full of people I had never met before. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter that Nina knew all the details already, just being seen in that state, it scared me. I didn't want her to think that I was gone and not coming back, because that's how I felt at the time. And I felt so much better after I let it out, but at that time, right before that happened, is one of the worst feelings I've ever had in my life.
So, Howard, I want to capture the language Joel used. He said if Nina or any loved one saw how broken he was, that he would be left. That's pretty universal, isn't it? For all of us, that's the definition of intimate relationships. We're just scared. The stakes are so high.
Indeed they are. It's just very fearful that we will be judged, and especially as men who are supposed to be in control and supposed to be strong, to be seen as vulnerable, to be seen as weak, to be seen as wounded or broken is really, really tough for men to deal with. And, you know, fortunately there are people like Nina out there and many partners who will not make those judgments, but men don't know that. They don't realize that there are people out there who in their lives will provide them with endless support and endless understanding.
Well, we can't know that because we're so busy judging ourselves so harshly. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about male survivors of sexual abuse, what happens, why it's so hard to deal with it. And soon we're going to talk about how it plays out in intimate relationships, the good news and the bad news. And we're also going to talk, of course, about what can be done about it. But and our number is 888-477-9499. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Mike on the line. Hey, Mike.
Yes, hi, Dr. Dan.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to certainly compliment you and your guest and say what incredible courage I think you both have discussing your personal situations.
Thank you.
One of the points I would like to make, and I'm going to preface it by saying there is absolutely nothing normal about sexual abuse, whether it's on females or on males. But one of the points that I think might be made as to why it's more horrific for a man or why it's more difficult for a man to recover is that if a female is sexually abused, again, it's horrible. It's unforgivable. However, it's typically more what would be considered a, again, normal, forgive the word, cross-gender sexual act, whereas with men it's typically a homosexual male-on-male act, and that's even far more difficult to accept or to deal with.
Well, you make a good point, and I appreciate your call, Mike. Howard, it does raise an issue. I'm sure one of the byproducts is sexual identity.
It does create a lot of confusion for men who are abused by males. Sexual orientation is actually determined from what we know from most experts when we're born. So it's not that sexual orientation is determined by sexual abuse, but men certainly suffer a great deal of confusion about it and about their own masculinity. It's important to note that males and females abuse men, not just men. And so while it's true what Mike is pointing out, that it does create that kind of confusion, for a man who's abused by a female, he encounters a very different kind of trauma in that it's hard for him to even conceptualize in some ways that it was abuse for some men, that they regard that as they were lucky and fortunate, and that's how our society sees it. So again, they're not seen as victims.
Hmm. I want to come back to the issue of what Joel brought up about body memory. Excuse me. I think this is so important that our bodies, whether we're abused or not, our bodies hold the truth of our lives. You know, they experience our lives without judgment, without, you know, they just experience it. I don't know if you're familiar with a psychologist, I don't even know if he's still living, called Eugene Gendlin. And he talks about focusing. His book is about focusing, that before you can label an emotion or experience, it's about focusing on what part of your body is calling for attention.
I'm not familiar with him, but I would say that the body memories are very common for most survivors, and they really are, in some ways, tremendous gifts. They're really terrifying at the moment that a man experiences that body memory, because it doesn't make any sense. There aren't any dots that a man can connect to what he's experiencing. He just knows that I'm feeling something in my body that feels wrong, that's making me really uncomfortable. And it takes some time to be able to connect the dots that, okay, this is because I was abused. You know, some men who were anally raped, for instance, will feel a tightening in their anal area when there's some kind of story on TV about it, for instance. Sometimes men who've been abused at a certain age will have children at the same age, and they'll experience some of those body memories when they're just interacting with their kid, or maybe when they're changing a diaper. I mean, it's really fascinating how body memories surface, but they do provide immense clues to us.
Joel, in your essay, you said that you never experienced joy, and that the closest you came was your sense of accomplishment through your academic success. In hindsight, do you know why you couldn't experience joy?
I think a lot of that had to do with other kinds of abuse that existed in my household. I don't think that the sexual abuse determined that. I think that being constantly beaten down emotionally by my stepfather made me see myself as worthless. And you know, I think it's important to point out to the listeners that sexual abuse often exists at the same time as other forms of abuse. And many times the emotional abuse can be so much worse. I think it was for me.
So you experienced yourself as worthless and therefore not entitled to feel joy.
Right.
My hunch is you never saw joy in your family anyway.
It wasn't all bad. I have to be clear about that. But any time I felt something I would consider joy or happiness, it was always muted by all this other stuff that was being ignored.
Can I, this is all very personal and emotional. Can I ask you how you're doing right now, Joel?
Not terrible, not great either, but I think, you know, Howard was just talking about that kind of body sensation, specifically, yeah. I recalled when I was sitting down in a chair, and this is a few months ago, and I was just praying for any sort of memory, and this wasn't the same time as what was depicted in the book, but another time where I was trying to remember anything that could possibly confirm for me what happened to me. And I felt this very strong sensation in my rectum, and it freaked me out, and I'd never felt anything that intense or disgusting or vile in my life that I've been conscious of. So, you know, I feel that weighing in my gut right now, for sure.
Yeah, I see it. I see your breathing's a bit shallow. Are you aware of any emotions you're feeling right now?
I feel like I started to drift a little bit. I was listening, yeah. But yeah, there's always been a certain degree of dissociation from my body when these things happen, and it's hard for people. It's hard for me to explain that to people. Like Nina has seen this many times, where I'm physically there. I'm obviously there, but I'm not there.
Right.
And
right.
I hate it. I wish I could. I try my best to make sure I'm anchored where I am, but it is so difficult sometimes.
Hey, my friend, when you're not there, it's because a part of you is trying to protect yourself. It's healthy. Don't fight with it, okay? It's good. It's holding you, okay? All right, so let's take a break, and let's all of us catch our breath and find some tissues for all three of us. We're talking about male sexual abuse with psychologist Howard Frankin, who's really an expert, if not the expert, on the topic. He wrote Joining Forces, Empowering Male Survivors to Thrive. Joel and Nina Hoffman are here in the studio. They've told their stories and many other stories in the Survivors Project, telling the truth about life after sexual abuse. When we come back, we're going to hear more about the issues involved. We're also going to meet Nina Hoffman, who has a wonderful and important story of her own to tell. Our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Is your child struggling in school? Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley Friends, a Quaker College preparatory school in Paoli for students who learn differently. Delaware Valley Friends is committed to providing small classes, individual attention, state-of-the-art technology, and an accredited curriculum and faculty for grades 6 through 12. Open house on Wednesday morning, December 12th from 9 to 11 a.m. More info about Delaware Valley Friends at dvfs.org. Still considering applications for mid-year transfer students.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about male sexual abuse with psychologist Howard Frankin and Joel and Nina Hoffman, who've written a very powerful and important book of essays called The Survivors Project. Let's go right to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Sean.
Yes, hi, Doctor.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm uncomfortable talking about this after hearing the other gentleman speak. I was raped, molested, whatever it is that happened in second grade by a nun. And anyway, I was a drug addict, or I am a drug addict and alcoholic, who's been clean for 24 years. And, you know, every time I went into a rehab or detox, I would talk to a therapist or psychiatrist, and when I would bring that issue up, they would pause, look at me, and say, we have to get back to that. And no one ever got back to it. And I'm just wondering, I was beaten by my father, and that, so I didn't like that. That was being hurt. But what this nun did to me, it wasn't, to me at the time, was not violent, or she wasn't hitting me. It sounds strange. It felt good. It was whatever it was. She was my girlfriend.
Sure.
And she told me about her last boyfriend. And so some people say to me, there's no way that could not have affected you. I have 7 siblings. They're all married and with children. I myself had 3 opportunities to do that and did not, because in my heart I knew I was a drug addict and alcoholic, so I wouldn't do that to these women that I love. And
So there's
anyway,
there's this quality.
I just want to know. I mean, that did that affect me, or like, I don't think about it often until it comes up on a show, and then I just want to know, are these people right that there's no way it could not have affected me?
Sean, if you were with me, I would want to make eye contact with you and ask you that question. Did it affect you?
Did it affect me?
Yeah, did it affect you?
Yes, but not in, like, I don't look at it as it being so horrible until in my 30s. I had a woman psychologist, and I told her about it. And I was also telling her about the love I had for my nephew. He was a little kid, and I just, getting that unconditional love from him was pretty powerful for me. And she said to me, what if that happened to your nephew? And it was the first time in my life that I ever felt really angry about it. And like, my anger didn't go to the nun. It just, my anger came up to think that someone would do that to my nephew. It just,
anger.
It angered me.
Anger at the injustice. You know, you're
exactly.
Sean, you're bringing up a lot of important issues, and I want to turn to our experts to deal with a bunch of them. Can you just tell us quickly, how are you now at this point in your life?
Well, with that issue, I'm
No. That's not what I'm asking. That's not what I'm asking, Sean. I'm asking about your life, the big picture. How is your life?
My life is, I have an incurable non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Just came up with 3 years of chemotherapy. And after 1 year, I went back, and now I find out I have cirrhosis of the liver. But my life is great. I have a great life. I have people that love me. I have people in this program, AA, that love me. And I just get up every day, and I when people ask me about it, I say, if I have a chance to laugh today, why would I want to lay in bed?
Sean. Sean, I appreciate your call, and I appreciate more than anything your teaching just now. Thank you so much, and I wish you continued laughter. So I want to bring up one issue, and then I'm dying for all of us to get to know Nina here, but I want to bring up this issue of that Sean brought up about his therapists and therapists not coming back to it. And, you know, the media, too, doesn't do a very good job. You know, Joel, when you came in this morning, you were showing us an article in today's Inquirer that what's this, the anniversary of the Sandusky thing? But it's, you know, they're not really addressing the victims, the humanity of the victims. Howard, what's the problem here?
Our society has a great deal of trouble dealing with this topic. It makes people so uncomfortable. And I just want to say to Sean and to anybody like him, if you're dealing with drug and alcohol addiction, I mean, I'm so grateful that Sean, you have all that recovery. And it's really important in my work with addicts, whether they're drug addicts, alcoholics, or sex addicts. Shame is at the root of all that addiction, and the shame is caused by that kind of abuse. And it's really important in treatment that it be addressed, and it's an injustice in that treatment that people say, let's get back to that. It's understandable if somebody's in the midst of an addiction and acting out that you have to deal with the addiction, and you also have to deal with the underlying roots of the addiction, which oftentimes is that kind of abuse. So it's really important that it's addressed.
Nina, I want to know about this relationship with Joel here. You met him when all of this was buried inside, and he kept people at a distance through sarcasm and hostility. Why didn't you run like the wind? What's the matter with you?
I saw something in Joel that I cannot explain to this day. I saw the sarcasm and I saw the hostility, which was directed toward me on the first day that we met. And I wrote him off for a good 24, 48 hours. And there was something in him that just told me, stick with this guy, he's good. And despite what he wanted me to see, I saw something completely different.
Howard, intimacy really is a major issue here. I've got a patient years ago who, when she was beginning to feel closeness and trust, even intimacy in our relationship, she began to keep her coat on during the session, regardless of the weather. And she was protecting her body because intimacy to her put her at risk.
Absolutely. You know, one of the problems is that most people who are sexually abused are abused by somebody who is close to them. It's by somebody who's known to them. It's by somebody who they trust. And so the whole violation, the whole betrayal of that trust is what makes intimacy so difficult, because you come to accept that this person cares about me. Perpetrators oftentimes will say, I care about you, and then they will victimize. The person, the man, the woman, and that's what makes trust so extremely difficult.
Joel, so here you are. You meet this woman who, in my humble opinion, is sweet and beautiful. And what happens to you when you met her?
I ran 100 miles in the other direction.
Ran from? What were you running from?
Nina, I had a habit of dating women who I also thought were broken, because I figured only those kinds of women could possibly relate to and understand me. And Nina was so different, but at the same time, I was drawn to her. And she actually enjoyed her life and she wasn't miserable. But at the same time, I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle such a good person in my life at that time, and I broke it off. And a few months later, things started to click for me that maybe this could work. But unfortunately, for a very long time after that, we struggled. And only in the past few months or so have we really gotten on strong footing. And I am so grateful that she stayed with me throughout that.
You said we struggled. What was your struggle? You know, you talk about running and you talk about pushing her away and breaking off. What's the emotion there that felt so frightening to you, if there is one? What were you?
It's sickness. It is deep existential sickness. It is worse than any flu I've ever had. It is worse than any injury I've ever had. It just feels like my gut is full of poison and I can't let it out. It doesn't feel as much like that anymore, but that's how I felt for a very long time, that I simply couldn't let it out. And I think a lot of that had to do with most of my family having no interest in discussing the issue and, you know, saying, well, haven't you moved on already?
Were you aware at the time of how much you wanted closeness and intimacy?
I was aware. But every time I got that close, I pulled back because I was too afraid that it would blow up in my face.
Yeah.
So it was a perpetual cycle, and fortunately this time it didn't happen like that.
Yeah, Howard, this is, you know, what Joel's describing is quantitatively different from all relationships. You know, we fear intimacy. We fear that if anybody sees our darkest parts, you know, we'll be judged and be not accepted.
It is something that many of us struggle with. I think male survivors just have an extra layer of that fear of rejection that is so palpable and so powerful that it really is terrifying. You know, there's that saying in 12-step programs that we're only as sick as our secrets. And I do think that part of what sounds like has been helpful for you, Joel and Nina, is being able to tell those secrets and being able to put those out and share them with each other and then share them with the public so that sickness is healing, that you're finding support and you're finding people who understand, and it makes a huge difference.
Nina, what was it like for you early in the relationship?
When we first started dating, there were lots of things about Joel that I found puzzling, that I thought, you know, this isn't how my former boyfriends used to act. Is this something that I should be concerned about? But like I wrote in my essay, I didn't call Joel out on any of those things until after we got married.
Why?
I don't know why, but I think it was because I hoped that it would go away.
What were you feeling towards him? I mean, there's this kind of holding on that I feel. It's you know, the kind of wishful thinking that people in love have.
It was definitely wishful thinking. I think when you're a woman and you love a man so much, you just want it to be right. And I wanted it to be right so badly. But I started to feel a growing resentment.
Yeah.
Because I just couldn't get certain things that I felt that I needed. I mean, forget what I wanted. Certain things that I just needed as a wife and as a woman and a partner.
Okay, so here you are with this guy, and he's a little weird, but, well, maybe not a little weird. Okay, but there's something in there that you love, and he comes towards you and runs away and comes towards you and runs away, and he's not able to open and give you what you need, so you decide, let's get married.
It sounds a little weird when you put it like that, doesn't it?
yeah.
I, it's hard to explain intimate relationships, but I just knew that Joel loved me, and I could just see in his eyes that he really, really wanted to be with me and make it work. And I just was so overcome by that desire.
You can see in his eyes there's a kind of sweetness and tenderness in there. It's really visible, and I've no doubt it was visible before all this.
Immediately.
Came. Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Louise on the line. Louise? I guess there's a problem with the phones. I will tell you her question. Howard, it's directed at you. And it's a follow-up, I guess, from what happened, when the therapist never came back to the issue of sexual abuse. Louise wants to know how to approach a patient's possible abuse. She's a therapist in training.
I think it's really important for therapists to be thinking about the possibility with men that they have been abused. And a lot of times therapists don't even ask those kinds of questions. And it's important to understand that a patient's going to open up when he feels safe enough to do that, just because you ask the question. And especially with men, it's important to ask questions about, was there ever a time that somebody touched you in a way that didn't feel right, as opposed to just asking the question, were you sexually abused? Because a lot of men will not conceptualize what was done to them as sexual abuse, and of course many men have this buried. But what's not buried is their shame. What's not buried is the problems they're having in their life. And if you can help men open up enough about those problems, you can begin to help them make dots and begin to ask questions about the past that will help them to be able to talk about it. It's a slow process, but it's absolutely possible for men to trust therapists so that they can speak this truth.
Well, so the one point for therapists to know is it does happen to men, and it does happen to men very frequently. That's number one.
Absolutely.
And number two, therapists have to be willing to face and deal with their own anxiety around this, because those who don't talk about it when it comes up, it's about their own anxiety. Listen, we've got to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to take more callers, and we're going to be talking about the healing process, what we know, and we're going to hear more from Joel and Nina. We're talking about sexual abuse of boys, and of course this topic's not for everyone, certainly not for our very young listeners. The voice you just heard was Dr. Howard Franken. He's a psychologist. He has written Joining Forces, Empowering Male Survivors to Thrive. I'm also joined here in the studio by Joel and Nina Hoffman. They are co-editors of the Survivors Project, Telling the Truth About Life After Sexual Abuse. It's a collection of essays by survivors of sexual abuse. Well, our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about male sexual abuse with psychologist Howard Frankin and Joel and Nina Hoffman. Joel and Nina, we're talking about the early stages of your relationship and how difficult it was for both of you. And I, Nina, I was kind of playing with you when I talked about, so then you decided to get married. But what did happen somehow, and maybe Joel, maybe the question goes to you, when did trust begin to happen and how?
There was a pivotal moment in this, and I can recall what it was, but not exactly when it was. And I was very jammed up. I was struggling a lot this particular day. And Nina, who had been dealing with everything, said, I can't deal with this right now. You have to deal with this yourself. I'm not getting what I need. I need to back away. And, you know, for years, I had let my father take care of all these issues for me and explain to me what was, why I was feeling how I was feeling. And I really did myself a disservice that way. But when Nina pulled back, I was left to deal with it myself. And when I dealt with it myself, it was an epiphany that I really didn't have to rely on someone else to fix it for me, that I could fix it myself. And over time, these events occurred repeatedly where I would get really jammed up and then take care of it myself and still talk with Nina about it afterwards or talk to a therapist about it afterwards. But I had control, finally. I don't know how it happened, but if Nina hadn't pushed me in that particular way at that particular time, and if she hadn't been a person who I trusted as much as I trust her, I don't think it would have worked.
Nina, what about you? When did trust start to happen? When did you feel safe?
Yeah, it came only after we started therapy, because we waited months, I think 5 months, to get into therapy. And before that, I did not know how to deal with Joel. I didn't know how to deal with my feelings, and I didn't know how to help him.
What did you learn in therapy?
I learned many things. I learned how to communicate effectively with your partner, which seems silly. Because, you know, you think that you know how to talk to your spouse, but when you're going through such intense emotional upheaval, you have to learn how to negotiate. And, you know, we learned how to compromise, and I learned, probably most importantly, how to take care of myself while Joel was going through his own thing.
Well, listen, Nina, I'm a trained observer, and I noticed when you came in, either you have a significant eating disorder or you're very, very pregnant. So how is that? Are you happy about having a baby with Joel?
I am more happy than I can even describe. It's what I've wanted for so long.
Joel, any anxiety about becoming a father?
Not at all, which None. Is bizarre to me. I thought that I would be so nerve-wracked over the possibility of having a child, because for a long time I thought I would never get married, never have a child. Now I have both, and things finally make sense to me, and I feel like I have a chance to allow my daughter to have the childhood I didn't have.
You're having a daughter?
Yes.
Yeah. So you're happy? You're not worried about what kind of dad he's going to be?
Joel's going to be a great dad. I'm worried that Joel's going to be a better dad than I'm going to be a mom.
Do not be competitive around this stuff. Listen, Joel, Nina, and Howard, I mentioned that I've got an essay I want to share with you about my story, and I'm going to say goodbye to you guys now, and I'd love you to listen to this essay. I've been talking about male survivors of sexual abuse with Dr. Howard Frankin and Joel and Nina Hoffman. Again, thanks all of you for joining us. Now to a personal story I want to share. The sickness that hurts everyone. He was a respected teacher and father. He was a scout leader, and in 1958, he was the idol of most of the children in my middle school. He was relatively young and a powerful man who cared about children and quickly became a father figure for many of us. He seemed to like me and saw great potential in me. He was the first adult who really believed I had something special. By age 12, I had already experienced difficulty in school because of what turned out to be a learning disability. But back in the 50s, underachieving children were generally regarded as lazy. He saw me as having leadership potential, and because of him, I felt good about myself for the first time in my life. He had a bachelor's degree in psychology and always wanted to become a psychologist. When he taught me about the field, I really felt this was something I could do well and help lots of people. At age 12, I knew I would become a psychologist because of that man's influence. The following month, he invited me to join a special leadership club. I was honored by the invitation, so I went to his house after school for our first private meeting. He told me the first rule of leadership was to be able to take orders without questioning them. 30 minutes later, I was naked in his bed. Like most children who were sexually abused, I didn't feel anything that day, nor did I feel anything the next week when I went back for what was to be my last visit to his home. Nor did I feel anything for the next decade. When I was a graduate student at Temple University, I bumped into him in the cafeteria. After all these years, he was finally taking some graduate courses in psychology. I didn't really feel anything then either. I didn't wonder if he was still acting on the sickness. I didn't wonder about all of the other children who were in his leadership club being affected by the sickness. I didn't feel anger or fear. I just felt like a graduate student bumping into an old teacher of his. But as I've learned over the years, buried feelings are always buried alive. Later that semester, I was driving back to campus from my internship at a local rehabilitation hospital. I heard a news flash on my radio that almost caused me to have an accident. The announcer said, "This man, now a principal in a middle school, had been caught with child pornography, and before he could be arrested, he went home and murdered his wife, his children, and killed himself. Nearly blinded with shock, I pulled over and got out of the car to try to get my bearings and catch my breath. Minutes later, I was bent over with dry heaves. I don't remember what happened after that, but I imagine I felt very alone. Most children who experience any kind of abuse feel alone in the world, not knowing how to cope with all of the emotions that surround this kind of violation. For some reason, we feel the shame that the abuser should rightly feel. But because of our shame, the story goes underground. And for many, that shameful secret begins to inform our personalities. For some, intimacy is too frightening, so it gets rejected. For boys, many wonder about their own sexuality and become hypersexual just to prove something to themselves. But like anyone who's experienced any trauma, what we really need is understanding, compassion, and God knows safety. Sexual abuse, more often than not, is a betrayal of a relationship that was once trustworthy. And real healing can only take place in the context of a relationship that is again safe, understanding, and trustworthy. But because of the shame, the silence continues until... Many years later, I was teaching family therapy in a graduate school here in Philadelphia and was becoming very anxious after the class was over. After examination, I realized that I had been sexually abused for the first time. Kind of amazing for a professional psychologist not to realize what happened to him when he was 12 years old. But once I realized, I knew what I had to do. I felt a responsibility to use my experience to help others. And the more I talked about it, the less shame I felt. After all, when anything stays in the dark too long, it develops mold that can become toxic. Exposure to sunlight helps kill mold, so I decided to expose my story to sunlight. I felt comfortable that my experience in seventh grade was understood, worked through, and became an experience I could use to help others. And then I began to prepare for today's show, and I felt emotions I hadn't felt before. It's as though all of the scar tissue was torn away, and I felt things for the first time. I felt the anguish of little 12-year-old Danny living with this shame for all those years. I felt the anguish of all of the children affected by the sickness. When I thought of his wife and children who were killed because of the sickness, I began to cry. The man I trusted had a terrible sickness that harmed so many people and killed several. May he and his family rest in peace, and may all of us affected by that sickness live in peace. Please comment on today's show by going to whyy.org/voices. I would love to hear from you. And you can download this and other voices shows there or on iTunes. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Emily Haas and Jennifer Lynn helped produce this show. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Take care, my friends. Enjoy your week.
Tell Me More is next on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Foundation's